In our lesson today, I want to continue the series that we've been doing, going through each of the books of the Bible, summarizing it so that we understand them a little bit better. We got up to the book of 1 Corinthians. I managed to do one of these lessons about once a month. But this letter is in our Bibles. It's a letter by Paul that shows us the difficulties of living a Christian life, especially in a society that's completely given over to idolatry and immorality. This letter, like other letters of Paul, are found in a codex. The oldest one that we have is commonly dated about 200 AD, though there is at least one scholar I found who says that, no, that's probably 90 AD is a better date for this particular codex. It's called P46. I found an interesting discussion of it. I wanted to share this with you. It says this codex of the letters of Paul was made out of a single quire. That is to say, 52 papyrus leaves were put on top of each other and then folded in the middle, thus forming 104 leaves holding 208 pages of text. If a codex is made out of one quire, the scribe must carefully calculate how much text the book will have to hold before he starts to write. Once he has passed the middle page, there's no way to correct the mistake. You can't add more pages. For any sheet of papyrus added at the end of the codex will have to give an empty first page, because you got to layer them. So you can imagine how difficult the calculation was. Consider, for instance, the example, the problem of the inner leaves. When you fold a heap of paper in the middle, the inner leaf will stick out, and you'll want to cut them so that the book looks nice. As you layer them, they stick out in the middle. So you cut them to make them look nice. And this was what was done to P46 before the scribe started writing. Now, if you do that, you should be aware that the inner pages are smaller than the outer ones and will hold less text. For some reason, the scribe of P46 made a mistake when he calculated the amount of paper he needed. After he filled in more than half the book, he realized that there wouldn't be not enough room for all the texts that he planned to copy, so he started to write more characters on each line and gradually increased the 26 lines per page in the first half of the codex, the 28, and then the 30, and then the 32 lines per page. Although the manuscript is in fairly good condition, the outer pages didn't survive. So the text starts with Romans 5, verse 17, and runs through Hebrews 1, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Ephesians, Galatians, Philippians, Colossians, and ends at 1 Thessalonians 5:28. Because many pages still provide their original page numbers, it is easy to see that seven missing outer leaves were holding 14 pages of text at the beginning, left room for 14 corresponding pages at the end. There is no way for to get the rest of the 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus and Philemon, and so on, in 14 pages the size of P46. Fair estimate lies somewhere close to 23 more pages would be necessary to hold all of the expected text. So what the scribe decided to do, we do not know. It's not necessary to assume that some missing letters were unknown to the scribe, although that, of course, could be possible, but the scribe evidently had difficulties with the length of the text. Two fragments of papyri codexes contemporary to P46 have been found in the sands of Egypt, one of them P32, preserving the text from Titus, another one P87, the text from Philemon, thus proving those letters were known at the time in that region where P46 was produced. What caused the unusual sequence of letters? Why is Hebrews put between Romans and 1 Corinthians? Why does Ephesians precede Galatians? I think the solution is very simple. It was crucial for a scribe properly to calculate the length of text before he started to write a codex consisting of a single quire. Faced with this situation, it's probably a good idea to arrange the different parts according to the lengths of the text before you start to copy the text. If you start out with the longest letters and end with the shorter ones, the chances are good you can finish the codex at the end of a letter even if your calculations were wrong. In this case, all the scribe would need to do is produce an extra volume out of some additional leaves holding the missing letters. But if you start out with the short letters and end with the long ones, the chances are much higher that you'll be right in the middle of a letter when you hit the last page. And who would want a book that ends in the middle of the text? And so that's where a lot of the order, if you start thinking about it, this is where a lot of the order of our text come from. Why certain things are in certain ways, where we get certain text in there, and why certain people are making certain assumptions. I thought it was a pretty good illustration, even though it's not really about 1 Corinthians. But it does tell us about where some of these manuscripts come from. That was by the way, by David Tarash in a thing that was titled Otis Extended Editions of the Letters of Paul. We have the letters of Paul. They were circulated very early on in the Christian churches. And the background as far as the confidence that we have the text is quite high. That is exactly what the early Christians had. And the letter that Paul wrote to Corinth, there's no debate about whether Paul wrote it. This is about one of Paul's letters. Where is Corinth? Corinth is situated on a narrow band of land in the area that we now know as Greece. Corinth would be situated right here on this narrow band. This is only about 3 miles wide from the satellite view. It divides that land between Achaia, which is on the south, and Greece proper on the north. The population of Corinth at the time was about 400,000 people. So in other words, that region has a city there at the time Paul was there about the size of Omaha proper. So just to give you an idea about the size of it. It was the fourth largest city in the Roman Empire. What happened was because of where it was situated, boats would come into port at Corinth, very nice natural port. But if they wanted to go to the other side, it's a 200-mile trip around the outside coast. So what they would do instead is they pack up the boats on sledges, drag them across the 3 miles, and drop them off on the other side. Yeah, it takes several days to get them dragged across, but it was a lot faster, a lot safer. And also, that particular area, the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, were notorious for the winter weather. You didn't have to put up with the possibilities of shipwreck by taking this shortcut. Nowadays, by the way, you can see a little blue stripe. They have actually put a canal in between. Now they actually use it for float the boats across. But back in the days of Paul, they dragged them. Now, being a seaport, it was known for its immoral services available to the sailors. Sailors are cut off at sea, and so they had lots of services for the sailors. One of the Greek verbs for fornicating and debauchery is Corinthiasmos, and it means to act like a Corinthian. And basically that's, back in their days, Corinth was known as Sin City, kind of like our Las Vegas. The temple to Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, which Strabo, the Greek writer, claimed had 1,000 prostitutes working for it. Just to give you an example of what the city was like. This is a city where gambling, thieves, vagrants were common, all sorts of, any type of evil or sin that you want to get involved in, it was available there. And probably something you never even thought of. This is a city where the Corinthian church existed. Now try imagining if you're having a congregation in a city like that and trying to keep everyone on the straight and narrow. It'd be kind of tough. There'd be all sorts of pulls, there are all sorts of distractions, all sorts of temptations. Now church itself started by Paul during his second journey. Oops, there we go. By the way, that's what it looks like for real. That's so you get an idea. It's up on one of the mountains, looking across what would be Corinth, over across the bay. This is what the ruins of Corinth looks like. This up here on top are the ruins where the temple of Aphrodite was at. They had a commanding view of Corinth. But this is some of the. This was the market strip. You can't barely see it, but the road where they drag the ships is right down in here in front of this particular picture. Another picture of some of the ruins that are in there. It was a sophisticated city. It was not a small place. It's not backwoods. This is metropolitan, though, back at 2,000 years ago. Now, the church was started by Paul during his second journey. After Macedonia, Paul stopped in Athens, and then he continued on to Corinth itself. In Acts chapter 18, and starting with verse 1, it says, after these things he left Athens and went to Corinth, and that would be about AD 52, 53, somewhere in that time frame. And it was here that Paul met Priscilla and Aquila. Starting with verse 2, it says, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having received from Italy, or recently come from Italy, sorry, with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working for by trade they were tent makers. So Paul had skills in making tents. He happened to find another family who were also Jews who were tent makers in the city of Corinth. They got together and started staying together. And they were all both Christians as well, and they started teaching the gospel in that area. They coming from one direction from Rome, Paul coming from a different direction. But they stayed in Corinth and started teaching the gospel. Verse 4, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. A bit later, Paul had left Silas and Timothy, his companions, behind to help with the work in Macedonia, getting that established. And they came down, jumping back to Acts 17, and in verse 14, it says, then immediately the brethren sent Paul out to go as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. Now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens and received a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible. Then they left. So Paul went on telling Silas and Timothy, as soon as you can get a chance to get away, follow me. He was heading to Athens. I'm sure travel must have been really interesting back then when you don't know where somebody's at. Because they last Silas and Timothy would have known as Paul was heading to Athens. He didn't stay in Athens. He went on to Corinth. So they would have to keep following him. So it takes a little while to catch up with somebody. But they eventually do catch up with Paul. Acts 18, starting with verse 5, then Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia. Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. We know from this that when from the letters from the Philippians, that when when Silas and Timothy came to Paul, they had brought funds with them. The church had sent extra funds with them. Paul could stop the tent making. He didn't need to do that to support himself now that he had enough funds, so he devoted himself full time to teaching the gospel at that point. Unfortunately, the Jews in Corinth rejected the gospel, and Paul then began focusing on the Gentiles. In verse 6, and when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads, I am clean. From now on I will go to the Gentiles. So they had their chance, but they chose to stick with their law, regardless of the facts. That was more important to them. And so Paul moved out of Priscilla and Aquila's house and into the home of Jason. Or Justice, sorry, not Justice, Jason. Justice. Justice happened to be next door to the synagogue, the very group of people that didn't like Paul and had blasphemed him. In verse 7, then he left and went to the house of a man named Tadeus Justus, a worshiper of God, whose house was next to the synagogue. Paul was an idol. He was still talking to the very ones who had rejected him. And what we find is, even though he originally had rejected him, Crispus, who was the head of the synagogue, became a Christian. Verse 8, Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household, and many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and were being baptized. Crispus believed the gospel, others then also then began following. Paul continued to teach in Corinth, and he taught there for 18 months, a year and a half. Starting with verse 9, and the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you. No man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city. And he settled there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. As he continued to teach, the Jews that were left in the synagogue tried to again cause problems. In particular, the man who took over Crispus' spot after he became a Christian, Sosthenes, tried to take Paul to court. But the case got thrown out. As verse 12, it says, then Gallio was proconsul of Achaia. The Jews were with one accord, rose up against Paul, and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, this man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would have been reasonable for you to put to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look for it yourselves. I'm unwilling to be a judge of these matters. And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Gallio did not want to be a judge about Old Testament law. That's not his forte. He wasn't interested in it. He was a Gentile. And here they were bringing that law to him. Sosthenes got beat up by other people. Gallio knew about it, didn't say anything. So it shows you what situation, the court situation was like then too. They did not like the Jews. Paul then left with Priscilla and Aquila. He headed to Syria, then Centuria, and then eventually on the way back stopped at Ephesus. Starting with verse 18, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. And when he went with Priscilla and Aquila, in Centuria he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. They came to Ephesus, and he left them there. Now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews, and when they asked him to stay longer time, he did not consent, but taking leave of them, said, I will return to you again, if God wills, and he set sail from Ephesus. So he leaves Priscilla and Aquila in Ephesus behind to take care of things, but he had to go on. Now, it's in Ephesus that Priscilla and Aquila, those people who have just spent 18 months that we know of in Corinth, helping start a church, they met and converted a man named Apollos, a Jew from Alexandria in Egypt. Starting with verse 24, it says, now a Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the scriptures. This man, being instructed in the way of the Lord and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus, being acquainted only with the baptism of John. And he began speaking out boldly in the synagogue. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. So we get Priscilla and Aquila converting Apollos. And after they had converted Paulus, Paulus was really eager to preach. And probably knowing about Achaia from Priscilla and Aquila, then he went to Corinth. So in Acts 18, starting with verse 27, when he wanted to go across to Achaia, the brethren encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. And when he had arrived, he greatly helped those who had believed through grace, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, demonstrating by the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. We mention all this because there's a lot of these characters mentioned in the Corinthian letter. If you don't understand the background of it, they're just names. But, for instance, Paulus is mentioned a lot at the beginning of the Corinthian letter. Now we know how he got there, why he was there, how long he was there for. The occasion for the letter is that Paul eventually returns back to Ephesus. And in Acts chapter 19, starting with verse 1, it says, "And it happened that while Paulus was at Corinth, Paul passed through the upper country and came to Ephesus and found some disciples," probably as a result of the work of Priscilla and Aquila. But he thought, it turned out that they were disciples of John instead of the teachings of Priscilla and Aquila making him disciples of Christ. But he did come back and started working in Ephesus. While he was in Ephesus, some of Chloe's household came and told Paul about problems that were going on in Corinth. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 11, says, "For I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there were quarrels among you." So Paul begins to hear word that things are not so going so well at Corinth. Timothy was then sent to remind them how to behave, but since that time he had left. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, in verse 17, "For this reason I have sent you Timothy, who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord. He will remind you of my ways which are in Christ, just as I teach everywhere in every church." In other words, Timothy is not going to teach you anything different than I've taught you. He's going to remind you of the things that we talked about when I was there. Timothy was sent. Timothy had then left. Still, there were problems in the church. In fact, Paul planned to send him back. If we go back to the end of the book, to 1 Corinthians 16, and in verse 17, "I rejoice over the coming of Stephanas and Fortunus and Archaeus, because they have supplied what is lacking on my part." And I wrote down, I wanted the one about Timothy. 10. Thank you. "Now if Timothy comes, see that he is with you without cause of being afraid, for he's doing the Lord's work as also am I." So Paul planned on sending him back to continue that work because there's still problems going on there. But those gloomy reports from Corinth caused Paul to wonder if he needed to come personally and perhaps take a stronger hand in the matter. Going back to chapter 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 21. "What do you desire? Shall I come to you with a rod or with love and the spirit of gentleness?" These problems need to be solved. Either they're going to have to solve them themselves or Paul's going to help them solve it, and it won't be a pleasant experience. It appears also from that passage that we just read in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 17, also verse 18, which says, "They've refreshed my spirit in yours, having acknowledged such men," that Corinth has also sent three men over to Corinth, or over to Ephesus. And because of the way the letter's written, they probably sent a list of questions. They wanted to know, how do we handle these problems? How do we take care of these particular items? This letter that was written by Paul mentions in verse 1 that Sosthenes is a co-writer. Oh, there's that name again. That's the leader of the Jewish synagogue that took over after Crispus, the one who got tried to get Paul in trouble and ended up getting beaten up. He's now writing a letter with Paul from Ephesus. Paul converted Sosthenes too. He's now in Ephesus with Paul. And so we get to the actual letter itself. As far as an outline, a summary, we're not going to go into detail about the letter. It starts out with a greeting, as most letters do. And Paul then begins with something positive. Something that we ought to learn from that letter is that when you need to talk to somebody about problems, you're best off starting out with something that they're doing right. So that they, at least that's always in their mind, that this is what you thought first and foremost most important, what they were doing well. And so Paul expresses his thankfulness. And that takes us down to verse 9 of chapter 1. But Paul has some concerns. So starting with verse 1 and verse 10 in 1 Corinthians, he says, "Now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be of the same, made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment." Here's then the first and foremost problem. Who is it that we follow? Because one of the problems that Cleo's household has reported is their divisions. Who is it that we follow? And Paul starts out talking about the fact that they divided over leaders who they followed. They were following Peter, they were following Apollos, they were following Paul. But what are the names of Apollos and Paul come in? Because they were preachers in Corinth. Perhaps a mention of Peter. Maybe Peter traveled through that area too at one time. We don't know. But they were talking about various people, and some were saying they followed Christ. But Paul argues that should not be. We all are followers of Christ. There is no difference between. And so Paul then talks about the wisdom of God's plan. It starts in chapter 1, verse 18, takes us down to chapter 2, in verse 16. God has a plan, and there's wisdom behind it, though we might not understand it. Sometimes you talk to people, how would you want to convert the world? I remember reading the Reader's Digest once, and they talked about, you know, God would send a message across the radio waves, just magically, miraculously sending a message, and everybody would hear that message and suddenly convert. Now, that's not the way God chose. God chose a way that most of us would consider very inefficient. And it didn't involve him directly. He brought the word, but he insisted the man teach men. The preaching of the gospel. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 21, "For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe." People were told what God wanted. They had their own choice. God never forced anybody. In fact, it was so to the point that God didn't force it, he had men teaching men. It's not like you're rejecting God straight to his face, at least not to the people who are looking at it that way. It's a choice that God offers. And Paul continues to talk about that choice all the way down to chapter 2, verse 16. In chapter 3, Paul then talks about those who preach. I know we had a discussion in the adult class about 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and I pointed out to one person, you don't understand chapter 3 unless you understand that chapter 3 is about preachers. Until you get that point across, You miss the point of the whole chapter. This is about the work, the labors. He says, starting in verse 3, he says, "You are still fleshly, since for there is jealousy and strife among you. Are you not fleshly? Are you not walking like mere men? For one says, 'I'm a Paul,' and another, 'I'm Apollos.' Are you not mere men? What then is Apollos, and what is Paul?" And that's really what the question is. Who are these people that are preachers that come into town and teach the gospel? Who are they? And Paul's point is, they're nobody. They're just workers. They're just laborers. Building on God's work. Working in God's fields. And he said Corinth is the field itself. And these men are just laborers in that field. They are just builders, putting the bricks on the building. The bricks are the Corinthians themselves. And so they are working for God. Now the problem is, as we go into chapter 4, is that there are people who really are rising up in Corinth who do not like Paul. We suspect they're probably the Judaizing teachers. And there are people saying things that are wrong about Paul. They're judging Paul. And so chapter 4 is basically about people judging Paul from chapter verse 1 down to verse 17. Paul takes that idea of judgment and turns it around. Starting with verse 18 of chapter 4 and going down to chapter 5, verse 8, Paul tells him about his judgment about the church. They were accepting a fornicator, of the nature of fornication that even the Gentiles found repulsive. And you've got to remember, this is Corinth. And yet they've managed to find somebody in the church that was doing a sin that was even to Corinthians repulsive. And yet they were accepting this person in the church. And Paul gives his judgment on the matter. And then tells them, starting chapter 5, verse 9, to chapter 6, verse 8, that Christians are to judge. You cannot sit back and say, "We do not make any judgments." Here's something that we find in the world all over the place today. People who say, as soon as you say, "Well, this is wrong, you can't judge me." This is the chapter to go to. This is the section to go to where Paul explains we are to judge. God gave us minds. We're to use them. We're to apply God's laws. We're going to see what is right and what is wrong. And then in chapter 6, he talks about the immorality that's going on among the Corinthians and how that ought not to be. So going from chapter 6, verse 9 down to verse 20, talking about particularly fornication, a prevalent sin in that society, and saying this is not a part of a Christian's life. The answer to fornication then brings up the next section, which is the questions about marriage. He then begins to answer the Corinthians' concerns. He left off the fact that they're involved in immorality. Now he's taking up the questions that they had. And the first question is, how close do you get to somebody? How much is allowed? That's where he says, concerning the things you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Sometimes this verse also is misunderstood, but he talks about marriage in chapter 7. First 9 verses is a fact about the need to get married. So often people read Paul's writings and think Paul's against marriage, and then quite the opposite. 7 starts out the fact that because of immorality, people ought to get married. In verses 10 through 16, he talks about the need that they needed to stay married. Some of these people were married before they became Christians. Is that marriage still valid? And Paul's answer is yes. Becoming a Christian doesn't change your marital status. You ought to stay married. You ought not to divorce one another. That idea then brings in chapter 7, verse 17 to 24, that they ought to stay the course. You don't make major changes just because you became a Christian in the sense of changing whether you're a slave or a free man, whether you're married or not married. Those things are not demanded by God. We change our behavior, not the external things. In chapter 7, verse 25 through 40, he talks about the unmarried and he encourages them to stay unmarried because of the upcoming persecution. Though he tells them very specifically, it's not wrong if you decide to marry. But it'd be probably better if you didn't because of the upcoming persecution. That then takes us to chapter 8, where Paul talks about liberty versus conscience. Making decisions. We're going back to that idea of judgment again. Making decisions between what you should do and should not do. In particular, in chapter 8, verses 1 through 13, what do you do when somebody has a conscious objection to eating things sacrificed to idols? How do you handle that? Paul then explains not only how to handle it, but in chapter 9, going from verses 1 through 27, so going through chapter 9, Paul talks about the fact that he as a Christian has liberty that's granted to him by Christ, but he does not take advantage of that liberty. He uses restraint on himself. There's things that he could do that he chooses not to do. If that's true, as he is an example, then how should the Christian in Corinth ought to act? So he goes back to talking about in chapter 10, immorality, that forbidden territory where they ought not to be into. Their liberty doesn't give them rights to do immoral acts, nor does it give them rights to offend other Christians. And then at the end of chapter 10, from verse 15 down to chapter 11, verse 1, he talks about the need to share. Talking about the sharing in the Lord's Supper, talking about also the sharing between them as they unify themselves into one, answering that problem with the dividing over various followers. In chapter 11, from verse 2 down to verse 16, he talks about authority, the proper order of authority. With God as being head, Christ being under him, then man and then woman, and why? In the end of chapter 11, from 17 to 34, he addresses the concerns about the Lord's Supper. They were misusing it. They were making it something it was never intended to be. How to properly give honor to Christ in his death. Going on to chapter 12, he addresses the questions they had about the spiritual gifts. He talks about in chapter 12 that there are many gifts, but doesn't make one person better than another. They had a problem with that in Corinth. They were dividing. One of the ways of dividing was that, hey, I can speak in tongues, you can't, aha. Maybe not that bold and that brash, but that's basically what they were doing. And Paul was saying there's many different gifts and they're all important. Even people with no gifts are perfectly important. Everyone in a church is important in different ways and for different reasons. Then going on in chapter 13, he talks about what really is important, that's love. If there is a gift that comes from God that should be most important, it's love itself. Going on to chapter 14, the first part up to verse 22, he actually says, well, of the various gifts, if you want to rank them, prophecy is more important than anything else because that's teaching God's word. There's where the importance ought to be, and it's much more important than speaking in tongues, speaking another language. The end of chapter 14 from 23 to 40 talks about the fact that worship is there for edification. It's to build people up. It's to make Christians stronger. That's why we are here in worship, and that's what the worship ought to be focused on. In chapter 15, Paul addresses problems about the resurrection. They had people teaching that the resurrection already passed. You missed it. Sorry. That's what was going on at that time. And Paul's saying, no, it's still to come. And it is important. And you can't say there is no resurrection, because that's core to the Christian teaching. In chapter 16, in the first couple of four verses, he talks about an issue about the collection for the needy saints in particular. That then leads to Paul talking about in chapter 16, from verse 5 to 12, what he plans to do. And his plans were that in about a year he was going to go to Corinth. When we get to the second Corinthian letter, we find out all his plans that he had made all went out the window because what he thought he was going to do didn't work out. Which, by the way, is an interesting predicament for those who believe in predestination, because here Paul's talking by inspiration about what he plans to do, and he doesn't get it right because he's not in control, and we learned about that. Things do change despite our best intentions. And at the very end of the chapter, from 13 down to 24, he gives salutations. He gives, so-and-so says hi. And obviously, Paul's been running across a lot of the Corinthians in Ephesus. And that's a very, 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 very quick summary of a book that we studied for about, what, a year and a half? I managed to do that in 45 minutes, roughly. But trying again to give you an overview, a broad view of each of the books so we understand what's there, where it's at, what we can find there. When we have problems, we need to deal with those problems. Where do we go for instruction? Seeing how Paul told the Corinthians to settle their problems is a perfect book about the issues that sometimes face us, because we are living in a society that's getting more and more immoral. We look at the Corinthians and say, oh, wow, you know, who could possibly have been a Christian in that age? We're going to find out probably. Maybe not in our own life, maybe our children or grandchildren's life. But it's getting there. We have to understand how to handle those problems and think about what it needs to be done. What we like to do, as we always do as we're gathered together, is leave an opportunity. If there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God and would like the prayers of the brethren on their behalf, again, we have an opportunity. Why don't you come forward? Have you stand and sing the song of selection.